We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Welcome to the RotoWire Fantasy Baseball Podcast, brought to you by WinBet. I'm your host, James Anderson, and we are fortunate enough to be joined this week by Phil Dussault, who obviously won the NFBC main event overall last year, won most of his leagues, had probably the best fantasy baseball season of all time. Phil, how you doing?
I'm good. How are you, James?
Doing great. As you know, we've been dealing with some technical difficulties here. Hopefully this time works out, but really appreciate you sticking around. My first question, are you getting tired of everyone kissing your ass all the time on Twitter and in podcasts?
It hasn't been too bad. It's been nice to get all these opportunities to get on nice podcasts, and they're probably podcasts I wouldn't be on if I hadn't had this kind of success. The one part I don't like, two things. One is not being able to be fully open and sharing everything. And the other one is if I get into debate about strategy or player, and then someone just says, well, obviously, you know what you're doing, you must be right. But I mean, I have as many insecurities about my player evaluation or strategy. I'm always questioning everything, just like everyone else. So it's not because I won last year that I'm feeling good and that everything's perfect. I keep trying to get better, and I want to have debate with people about players, about strategy, and I'm always open-minded about changing things and doing different things.
So just one thing that I've sort of realized over the years from being kind of on Twitter and like following a lot of people and seeing people, you know, tweet out their opinions and stuff like that, is sometimes I wonder if being on Twitter actually makes me better, maybe makes me worse. Do you have any sort of opinion on that in terms of just if someone's looking to really up their game, is it generally a good thing to be out there and be a part of the discourse?
I'd say being on Twitter and just getting into random debates probably doesn't make you a much better player. I think it's more about the connections you can make on there. Like there's three or four friends I talk to all the time in DMs and on Discord, and we make each other better. And I wouldn't have those connections without Twitter. But just debating with random people on Twitter probably isn't very productive, and it's probably more likely to affect your mood and make you angry than it is to make you a better fantasy baseball player.
Yeah, I mean, I think that makes sense. Now you've probably made so many connections over the past year or so, right? Like, I mean, how many, you know, how large has your circle grown since that awesome season?
The people I talk to all the time are still like three or four of them, with Toby, with Steve Weimer, and Rob DiPietro, who has the Pull Hitter podcast. And then there's a bunch of other people. Like just doing the RotoWire podcast last year with Jeff Erickson was like a dream come true for me. And then doing this here with you, doing the CBS podcast, talking frequently with Vlad, like all the names I heard about when I started playing 5 years ago, the people I looked up to, now those people are reaching out to me. That's really cool.
So, I'm kind of a pessimist, or maybe just not that much of an optimist, but I kind of like thinking about stuff like, you know, what's the worst version of this and that type of thing. You know, a lot of people probably look up to you and really trust everything you have to say, but what's the worst piece of analysis or advice you've seen a prominent analyst dish out so far this offseason?
Let me think. The thing about, I guess I've heard a lot of people say, I'm not paying up second round price for closers. That's crazy. But it's all relative. Like, paying second round for Liam Hendricks isn't bad when in the 10th round, the relievers are getting don't even have a job or are most likely to lose the job within like a month. So it's all... it's all relative. Like second round closers, sure, it seems early compared to what we're used to, but you have to get closers at some point. So you just have to compare that. And it's the same thing with catchers. People don't want to pay up for Sal Perez. I can't tell you whether or not it's a good idea without knowing where the other catchers are going. So it's all, I mean, we've seen it in football for the past 15 years where quarterbacks are in the most points. And now people stop drafting them because they know it's all about replacement value. So it is there. People understand baseball, but I still hear analysts talking about, oh, you can't pay second round for closers or third round for catchers. But it's all about comparing where the other players that position are being drafted.
Man, you probably just put a ton of people on blast just with that one. Because, I mean, you hear that. Like, I see that all the time. I see that, like, you know, almost daily. Like, anytime anyone tweets a draft board, someone's complaining about where the top closers are going, where the top catchers are going. If you are looking at a draft board, can you give me one player who's going inside the first 100 picks or so who you'd most harshly judge a fantasy manager for having on their team?
Like the easy ones are the injury prone guys, like Jacob deGrom, but you always have to put that into context because the ADP we have right now is $150 draft champions, which comes with an overall, and a big percentage of that 150 goes to the overall. So if you're taking deGrom in the mid to late second round, you have potentially like the number one overall player if he's healthy. So it's a risk worth taking. The one I don't like is, as weird as it's going to sound, it's Mike Trout. So he was supposed to be out 6 to 8 weeks and he missed 4 months. We think he's healthy, but we're not sure. Even if he is healthy, he had 8 stolen bases in his last 750 plate appearances. So, and now he's coming off a calf injury. So like the days of Mike Trout stealing 20, 30 bases are gone. So you're paying early second round for, even if he hits 35, 40 home runs with 300 average, he's a mid to late first round. So like the upside, like best case scenario, you're getting a value about 5 to 6 picks, but the downside is a guy who's hurt and doesn't play much. So like I prefer Acuna at that point, because if we're talking about high upside, if Acuna is healthy, last year he was going 1 or 2 with Tatis. So that's the upside with Acuna. The upside I don't see with Trout, even if he's healthy.
That's interesting. And that's we might come back to that here. I want to just quickly ask you about KDS, Kentucky Derby. The way that you figure out your draft order on the NFBC. Obviously you're someone who plays it, who, you know, you're going to do a ton of drafts between now and opening day. So, you know, getting the wrong spot in the draft and one of those isn't going to make or break your season. But do you have any sort of preference in terms of where the best place to pick this year is?
Right now, I think there's a pretty clear top 7 with Turner, Tatis, J-Ram, Bichette, Soto, Cole, and Burns. Vlad is there in terms of value, but just that the lack of stolen bases makes it harder to build a team around him. It sort of forces you to get stolen bases. And so I expect him to drop a little bit in the main events in the next in 2 months, I guess. So I'd say that top seven is probably my target right now. In the bottom of the first round, Otani's a bit of a wild card. He's got the great power, speed. It's just hard to evaluate how much that UT only hurts him in terms of value. Because he's up there with the other seven in terms of pure value, I think. But the UT only is so hard to evaluate. We're just guessing based on experience. And if you've had a UT only player that's been clogging your UT spot all year, you're probably fading Otani. Or if you've had a good player in your UT spot, then you're okay with drafting him. So it comes from our personal experience. There's no other way to really measure it, how much we should downgrade him for that. So, but like I like the top seven, but I'm doing multiple drafts. So I usually try to get like one early, one middle, one late, just spread it. Cause it affects, we always plan the first two rounds, but you try to go to five, six, seven rounds. Just because usually you in the fifth round, usually you won't reach a full round for someone. So if you have players that usually going, I know late fifth, early sixth, then you probably would need a pick in that range to get the proper value out of the pick.
Yeah, I was going to ask, like, how many rounds are you looking into the draft in terms of evaluating the KDS placement? I mean, I guess you kind of answered that.
Yeah, I guess because there's usually it depends on the year, but most years I usually see drop off around pick 100. So like six or seven rounds, I'll have a plan for those. And that's usually when you by the sixth round, you need to have your stolen bases, you need to have your at least an ace or two, and you need to have your saves, at least the way the ADP is right now. So I usually plan six or seven rounds to get those three things. And then after that, it's easier to fill in needs. And you, once you get to pick 100 or 120 or whatever, you can reach 10, 15, 20 picks for the guy that fits your team the best. So at that point, KDS doesn't really matter whether you're picking early or late.
And you were saying like you kind of want to be spreading it out, right? Like you want to kind of diversify sort of the areas where you're drafting from. So like you would, if you had your choice, would you want it to be like a 33, 33, 30, 33 split in terms of like early, middle, late?
Roughly. Yeah. Sometimes if I like the early picks better, like I said, a top seven, then I might be looking at like 2-6. And if I like, I don't know, Otani or Harper, then maybe 10 instead of 13 or 15, or if there's years where I prefer the late picks, then I might go to like 5, 12 and 15 or something like that. But I do try to spread it around, but I just move a little bit depending on what I prefer, whatever I prefer early or late. And it really varies depending on the year.
Now I'm hoping to meet you in Vegas here in a couple months. If you're doing a high stakes draft, would you prefer to do it in person? I know everyone loves that weekend in Vegas, that last weekend in March, or would you prefer to do it online?
If I'm doing just one and it's my first main event, honestly, I prefer in person for myself. I prefer in person for the experience, and I feel like I can beat anyone, so I don't mind the competition. If you're doing just one and it's your first main event, it can be easier to do it online. There's a bit of a stress in person if you're not ready. Just having the large room with other drafts and 14 other people around the table staring at you when you're getting to getting ready to make your pick. It's definitely different, but the experience is awesome just meeting people. So it depends on your personality and how ready you are and everything. But for me, I prefer in person. And I know we're supposed to have dinner together in Vegas, from what I heard.
Yeah, Todd told me to say hey. So yeah, that'll be fun. Really looking forward to that. Now, I know you've kind of teased some of your kind of process stuff before, but just kind of what I've noticed, or at least from reading the tea leaves of what you have said, is it fair to say that you largely trust per plate appearance projections for established hitters, the type of projections you can get publicly, and then do a lot of the performance projection work yourself on pitchers?
My process has evolved over the last 2 years. Mainly the short season sort of forced me to start doing all my own stuff. But it is a lot different. It is a lot easier to be different from the market in pitching than it is in hitting. Like I've crunched numbers and come up with my own formulas, and everything I've done, I'm not that far apart from Steamer and from the bat. It's just harder for hitters. So all the numbers are out there. For pitchers, there's so much more things to look at that it's easier. And like I had last year, I had Kevin Gausman as my 15th starting pitcher. I have others that didn't work out. I'm just using an example that I was right about to, because it sounds better. But like no one else had that. So it's easier to be different from the market in pitching. You can look at pitch mix. You can look at velo. You can look at arm angle. So many different things that can make you different from the masses.
Yeah, I mean that makes sense. And you know, even just sort of like sample size, like you don't need multiple seasons of a pitcher, right? Like doing the exact same thing before you could buy into what they're doing to some extent.
Yeah, exactly. Like for pitchers, sometimes 20 or 30 innings is enough to see that he's made a change. Most of the time it sticks, sometimes it doesn't. But for hitters, you can have 600 plate appearances and you can stay, well, he got lucky. Again, that's one way to get an edge as well, to not buy into to bad results for a hitter. But it's harder to do that for a hitter than for a pitcher.
So I've been vocal this offseason about there being too much noise in general in terms of the AAA hitting production last year. It was just such a weird environment where you were seeing lots of the top prospects just performed better at AAA relative to league average than they did at AA, which you don't usually see. And so, you know, I think I don't want to dismiss projections entirely, but like, I think it's dangerous to rely too much on projection systems for seeing how hitters who reached AAA last year might fare in the majors this year. What's your process for projecting prospects who have either no sample in the majors or a very small sample in the majors?
I've listened to a few of your podcasts and I've never heard you mention that. So when I saw the question, I looked into it because I've been relying on Steamer for young players. But then I saw your question. I'm like, oh, I'll look into it. James is a smart guy. I want to see if this makes sense. So I looked back from 2012 to 2019. I looked at hitters with at least 50 plate appearances in both AAA and the majors in the same year. And then the WRC plus in MLB was 74% of what it was in AAA. So someone who had a 125 WRC plus in AAA had an average of 93 WRC plus in the majors. And most years, it was actually really consistent, like between 72% and 76%, I think in 7 of those 8 years. So it was like a consistent number. The sample is large enough to make a judgment off of that. In 2021, that number was 67% instead of 74. So that that young guy who had a 125 WRC plus in AAA, we expected a 93, but he actually had an 84 WRC plus in the majors last year. So that what you said just totally makes sense. And I've said this before. I said I do podcasts to learn from people and make changes and improve my formulas. And when I tested that and I fixed my formulas, I've been relying on Steamer for young players. But what that basically tells me that AAA numbers last year are overvalued. So I had to downgrade a couple players because of that. And I know like it's not the way I did it isn't an exact science, but It does tell me that the gap between AAA and the majors was larger last year than it had been in the past at least 7 or 8 years. Yeah.
Nice. I helped the robot. that'll be my claim to fame this year if nothing goes right in my leagues.
Why do you think that? I was trying to figure out why, because I did the same thing for pitchers that didn't get the same results. So my sort of conclusion was that like for AAA pitchers, I guess like all pitchers, they didn't pitch in 2020. They limited innings last year. So the pitchers that would normally pitch, I don't know, 120 innings in AAA, they limited to 90 innings. And the extra 30 went to a guy that was normally in AA, and that moved up to AAA. So the pitching was weaker as a whole. So the hitting numbers were better than they would be in a normal year. I don't know if that makes sense or if you had another theory for it.
Yeah, well, I mean, the easiest way to sort of say it is the gap. I think the gap between AAA pitching and big league pitching was larger last year than it has been. Okay. Trying to dissect like all the different reasons why that was, I feel like there's just a ton of reasons that all kind of came together at the same time. But for instance, I mean, I think a ton of the pitchers who are at AAA just didn't have anywhere near like your average big leaguers amount of stuff from a velocity standpoint, just from a quality of the breaking ball standpoint. Whereas I think, and what I was saying, like the reason that it kind of jumped out to me was I would just notice I'd be evaluating a bunch of different hitting prospects who played at AA and at AAA last year. And just so many of them, well over 50%, it just, anecdotally, it seemed so many of them were better at AAA than they were at AA. And then I kind of went and looked at like, where are all the best pitching prospects pitching last year? You know, most of the best pitching prospects didn't make it to AAA at all, but a lot of them were hanging out at AA for a good chunk of the year. So I do think there was like a bit of a drop off just from a stuff standpoint of the pitching at AAA versus the pitching at AA. And then obviously just that gap from a guy that was having success against AAA pitching, going up to the majors. I mean, we saw just a ton of guys really fall off in a huge way last year. So I think the pandemic definitely played a role, but also teams were kind of using AAA, I think, more as just kind of a place where they would send their like weakest relievers or whatever, like just to kind of get working, and then they'd bring them back up and stuff. And the guys that they really had like a bright future but weren't necessarily going to contribute in the majors, they just kept those guys at AA. Okay. I think there's a lot of different reasons for it.
Okay, that makes sense.
But it's interesting. I don't know. Yeah. I'm encouraged that you did the research and it all kind of checked out on your end as well. All right. We're going to head to a quick break and a quick message from our sponsors. But when we come back, we're going to get some kind of – I'm going to give Phil a bunch of different sort of widely held strategy opinions, and he is going to weigh in as to how legitimate those are.
We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/BlueWire. Just go to Indeed.com/BlueWire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/BlueWire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Whether you're a world-class athlete or a podcaster like me, we all understand the importance of mental and physical well-being and proper recovery for top-notch performance. That's why I'm excited that Unified Healing is sponsoring podcasts on the Blue Wire Network. Unified Healing is a new and super innovative global network of wellness centers powered by Energy Enhancement System, or EE System. If you haven't heard of the EE System yet, then you'll want to listen up. This technology promotes wellness, deep relaxation, purification, and rejuvenation. Wherever you are across the globe, access to a center is easy and affordable. Interested in experiencing the EE System technology for yourself? Go to unifiedhealing.com/bluewire to learn more and find a center near you. That's Unified, UNIFYD, healing.com/bluewire. No material or testimonials on the Unified Healing website are intended to be viewed as medical advice or a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always seek the advice of your physician or other qualified healthcare provider with any questions you may have regarding a medical condition or treatment and before undertaking a new healthcare regimen, including EE System.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
If there's one thing we appreciate here at RotoWire, it's making good decisions, and even more so, making the right decision. Listen up, folks. I have an incredible offer for you with RotoWire's newest partner, WynnBET, the premier digital casino and sportsbook app. WynnBET is now the exclusive sponsor for RotoWire's fantasy podcasts. WynnBET brings you all the latest action with the user-friendly interface, moneyline bets, boosted parlays, over-unders, round robins, live betting, and so much more at your fingertips. Want a break from sports betting? Head into WynnBET's digital casino and take a spin on roulette. Double down in blackjack, slam the slots, or try your hand at baccarat. WynnBET is currently available in 7 states, Arizona, Colorado, Indiana, Michigan, New Jersey, Tennessee, and Virginia, while rapidly expanding. At WynnBET, the possibilities are limitless. WynnBET is currently offering all RotoWire listeners a risk-free bet up to $500 on your first wager. Download WynnBET now. That's WYNNBET, WynnBET, the exclusive partner for RotoWire's fantasy podcast. All right, Phil. This is probably the part of the podcast I'm looking forward to the most. There's such an echo chamber out there among kind of smart fantasy analysts, and I wonder sometimes if we're all just kind of doing the same thing too much. But I want to kind of like throw out these ideas at you and just kind of get your opinion as to sort of how valid these sort of widely held truisms are. All right. So the first one is you need to draft at least one ace.
That's a big false for me. I know I've sort of made my name from drafting pitching earlier than most people. One of the things I hear all the time is I'd be happy with this guy as my SP3, but not my SP2. But this isn't a major league rotation where you need like three aces to win a playoff series and need at least one or two dominant ones and all that stuff. Like if I have Joe Musgrove as my SP1 instead of Brandon Woodruff, obviously I'd prefer Woodruff, but if I can make it up with a better SP5, SP6, SP7, like all their stats count evenly. So you can make it up elsewhere, even if you don't have an ace. It comes down if for whatever reason I like a bunch of pitchers between picks 100 and 200, then I'll be drafting in that range. And my SP1 might be Musgrove, and then my SP2 through SP6 might be all in that range. So I'll have a worse ace, but I'll have a better SP5, SP6. So you can always, you can make up elsewhere. It's about the whole team coming together. It doesn't matter where, like, numbers don't matter. It's like the rank on your roster doesn't matter. It doesn't look as pretty when the guy at the top of your NFBC pitching staff isn't an ace, but if the ninth guy down there is better than everyone else's ninth guy, it works just as well.
That makes a ton of sense. All right. So this next one, you need to prioritize speed with your position players in the first 6 to 7 rounds.
That one I agree with. Last week on the Draft Champions podcast, I came up with this acronym I called KADU, which stands for Keep All Draft Options Open. In my projections, between round 7 and 20 in a 15-team league, there's about 20% of the player pool that I have projected for 10 or more stolen bases. So if you don't get your speed early, you need about maybe 8-10 stolen bases from every player in that range. So when you end up doing that, you're cutting down 80% of the player pool. And that's just not something you want to do, because if someone slips by 2 rounds that you normally like, but you just can't draft them because he doesn't have speed, then you're losing value there. So it's hard to find speed late. You can find it, but if you get speed early, then you keep your draft options open for the middle rounds. And I think that's where you can win your draft. And sometimes just the draft has gifts for you, and you have to be in a position to take advantage of them.
I'm glad that you went with that answer. Yeah, I mean, it's there's nothing worse than having to reach for a hitter who you don't really buy into their skills at all in the middle rounds, just because they might be able to get you 20 steals.
And we've all made that, like, you've all made the mistake. If we're picking, like, this year, if I have a pick at like 10 or 11, if I see Vlad there, it's going to be hard to pass him up. And then if I see Devers in the second round, it'll be tempting to draft him. But then you just put yourself in a position where you're just looking, all right, who's got 10 or 15 steals? Ah, this guy, I don't really like him, but yeah, I'll take him because I need the steals. And you're just doing that for like the next 10 rounds. And I've done it with batting average and with power, where you just cut down the player pool. Okay, I need all guys with 25 or more home runs, but you're just passing up so much value elsewhere when you're forcing yourself to do something.
All right, this next truism, it's smart to take at least one early catcher.
I'd say false. You can do it, but it's not a must. Last year on my overall main event winning team, I had Elias Diaz in 24th and Jose Trevino in 29th. And yes, I chased catchers all year in Fab until I found Dalton Varsho. And yes, I wasted Fab, and yes, it was a pain. But the rest of my team was so good that it was fine. So, and I guess one of the reasons my team was good is because I took other positions early. So if I'd taken catcher in the 8th, I might have missed out on a player that turned out to help my team. So I try to, like, positions don't matter that much, especially catcher. You can find catchers late. You can find catchers in Fab. If the value is there early, I've taken JTR in the 3rd when the value was there. But it's not a must. You just play the draft. I'm more worried about the balance in categories than specific positions.
So what's your sort of reaction? I mean, obviously you're right. Everything you said is on point. But what's your, you know, when you do the sort of auction calculator on Fangraphs and you use like Steam or whatever, it's going to spit out that, you know, Sal Perez is worth like a late first round pick basically by auction dollars. Does that, like, is that kind of close to what your own projections say? But then it's just about, well, yeah, he might be worth that in a vacuum, but I'm also passing on other stuff if I just follow that rigidly.
I have it differently. The way I do mine is I always adjust my values compared to the market. So if the calculator says that Sal Perez is a good value in the first, and then says JTR should be there in second round, another catcher that I don't have ADP right now, but like, you know what I mean, like if the calculator tells that every catcher should be drafted 2 or 3 rounds earlier than they're actually being drafted, then wherever you make the pick, you're going to get value. So in that case, I just bump down like all the catchers by $3 or $4 to match the market. And at that point, you can really compare. Okay, I have Sal about where he goes in the late third, but then I have, I don't know, Christian Vasquez around earlier than where he's actually going. So the real value is there with Vasquez. It's not there with Perez. So I think it's just all about balancing with ADP. What you want to do is at the end of the draft, look back and say, I got the best value out of my team where the players were going in that draft.
That's awesome. All right. The next truism, it's smart to take a couple closers within the first 8 to 12 rounds.
Yes. I've done it all the time. I've drafted closers early, especially since 2020, the short season, where you had to get saves early because the season was so short. So I figured that the guys that opened the season with the job would keep it. Even if they kept it for only a month, it was almost half the season. So I guess I started to draft closers early in 2020 and kind of stuck. In the context of an overall competition where you have to get saves, then you just pay the market price. And usually that's early. Usually the guys that go in rounds 10 to 20 are all the guys that we think are going to be closers and that the beat writers think are going to close, but we don't know. Last year, the early closers paid off, and the really late closers, like in rounds 25 to 30, there were a bunch of guys that we didn't expect that ended up starting the year with the job. So I don't like to play that game that much of speculating on closers. So my strength is finding late hitters and late starters. So I'd rather pay up for closers and deal with the rest later. But yeah, I like having those guaranteed saves on guaranteed saves in quotation marks on my team.
Hey, we have the same strengths, me and the robot. Very different levels of strengths, but strengths nonetheless.
Don't sell yourself short.
Well, so I mean, do you? You said you don't like to kind of play that game, like of trying to find late closers. Do you spend much time trying to sift through all that information and like see if maybe there is a guy going in the 20th round where you're like, actually, kind of think this is going to be the closer? Or do you just not? Do you think it leaves too much to chance to end up with that guy as your second closer in the event that you're wrong?
Right now, I'm not doing it. It's in Draft Champions League that Eric Hosmer in round 22 is going to be valuable at some point in the year, assuming he stays healthy and nothing changes with the Padres. But like you need that playing time. Once the leagues with Fab start, then Eric Hosmer isn't very useful because I can find the same player in Fab in week two. So in Fab leagues, then those picks in rounds maybe 22 to round 30, that's where I'll start playing that game. At that point, we have more information as well. You can look at usage in spring training. You can look at manager quotes and try to get a guess. Like one of my big picks 3 years ago was Greg Holland, round 30 in the main event. Everyone was assuming it was Archie Bradley. I couldn't find a single quote where they were saying it was going to be Archie Bradley. So I'm like, why not take the old guy in round 30 and see what happens? It worked out. He probably got 20 saves the first 3 months, and then he just started he was horrible after that, and I dropped him. But those 20 saves or whatever it was were very valuable. So, well, once we get closer to March, I like to play that game. But at this point, it's just not worth it. There's not enough information, and those picks in Draft Champions are too valuable to take random guesses.
All right, I'm on board with that. All right, the next one, players with increased risk of injury, especially pitchers, should be avoided in the early to mid rounds.
It's mostly true, but we have to make a difference between pitchers that are currently injured and those that we think are more injury prone. Jacob DeGrom right now in high money leagues, I'm staying away. But if he's throwing 100 in March, I'd probably be okay taking him top five. even if he's a perceived injury risk. If in spring he shows me he's fully healthy, I'll have no problem taking him. So I believe in the that currently injured pitchers, you don't know what to expect and it can often get worse. But once a pitcher is warmed up and throwing 100, I tend to believe that. And if he gets hurt in 3 months, then so be it. But that's kind of where I stand. There's, I mean, for hitters, I don't think we're as good at projecting injuries as we think we are. There's a handful of players like Buxton and Kiermaier, just because of the way they play, they're more likely to get hurt. But like Stanton was really injury prone, and he had two seasons of almost 700 plate appearances. Then he had injuries again. But staying away from currently injured pitchers. But other than that, I'm mostly I'm not trying to play doctor as much as others I've seen on Twitter.
Shots fired at Dr. Dave. All right, the last one. Taking players with little to no track record of MLB performance in the first 10 rounds is unwise.
Mostly true. Especially in 15-team leagues where replacement value is so much lower. They're just high-variance players. So if you have too many of those in 15-team league, you can then end up with say, three of them ending up in AAA within 2 months, and you have three spots to fill with such low replacement value. And in 12-team league where you can find players with regular bats on FAB, there's just a ton of them available, I'd be more likely to take chances like that.
Can you remember ever taking, like, let's say in the past, like, 2 or 3 years, ever taking, like, a top prospect in the first 150 picks or so?
No. Honestly, this is the first I've kind of done it. Not in my high money leagues, but it's the first I've really considered it. And that was before I adjusted my projections based on your question earlier. So I probably won't do it this year either. But no, I've never. Last year I drafted Alec Bohm. Last year I drafted, but he played. He played in 2020, right?
Yeah. So he doesn't really count, though.
Yeah, but like not like the. Not the hot prospect that we've only seen in AA, AAA. I'll rarely draft those guys. I wasn't drafting Acuna, Tatis, who else? Chris Paddock was the hot one. 1 year where he's just moving up. No, most of the time I avoid those guys.
So yeah, so like the Bobby Witt of this year.
I considered Witt in my early drafts, but now with my adjusted projections, he moved down quite a bit. So I'm not like in a 12-team league, I'd actually consider it, or even in a 150 DC just for the high upside. But unless his price really moves down for a main event, which I don't expect to, I think it'll go the other way. He's not a guy I'll be targeting.
All right, so this next short segment is going to basically just be an opportunity for you to tell me why I was wrong about a couple of picks I've already made. You've kind of already hinted at taking the other side on these. And they're not ones that I felt good about, which is why I wanted to ask you in the first place. But so in the first draft I did this year, you were also in it. I believe I was picking eighth. And I was deciding between Otani and Burns, and I went with Otani. You basically already kind of spoiled the fact that you would have gone with Burns there. And, you know, we were kind of talking a little bit about the util factor with Otani. Is that kind of the swing piece for Burns, or would you still take Burns over Otani if Otani was, like, outfield eligible?
If Otani was an outfielder, I'd be taking him. I'd have him – let's see. I have him sixth best hitter. If I take out the UT only, so right up there with Soto and Bichette. That's where I take him if he was outfield. It's hard to I had the same decision in my last DC. I went Burns, but I can't really argue against Ohtani because the upside is there, and it's so hard to the pitching is hard to evaluate. Like if the Angels with the 5-man rotation and he's making two starts in a week at least 4 or 5 times, then though those two start weeks are better than a hitting week in terms of pure value. So if you get extra there, then it makes up for the UT only. But I sort of want to see it as a bonus, not something to count on. But yeah, so I'd go Burns in that decision, but I can't, like, my guess is on this as good as yours, because he's such a unique player to evaluate. We're honestly just all guessing.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's totally true with him. It's such a, I don't think we've ever seen a player kind of with his sort of profile coming off that type of year, like in the middle of his 20s, and sort of seeing how he does trying to repeat it. And then this last one, so it was the last $400 DC I did. I started off with Max Scherzer and a couple other hitters I wanted, like Albies and Machado were gone, and I was deciding between Mike Trout and Starling Marte as my first hitter following an ace in round one. I went with Mike Trout. I'm guessing you're going to tell me I should have gone with Starling Marte.
I actually don't like either one. So I probably would have gone with Marte, but they're what pick was it? You remember?
It was like early 20s.
Okay.
So it was middle second. It wasn't early second.
Okay, that's not as big. He's been going early second. So I guess middle second isn't there's some room for upside. I'm sort of staying away from both just because both are, I don't like the hat. Like I like to count at least more than 600 plate appearances for my second round pick. Marte always seems to have some kind of injury. He'll play, but you can't count on 650 or 700 plate appearances from him. The guys that you wanted that didn't make it are the guys I'd be much more likely to target in that range. But yeah, sometimes you get left with decisions you don't like to make.
Should I have taken like Whit Merrifield or Cedric Mullins there? Because it was pretty bad. Maybe I should have gone with another pitcher there. I think the pitchers I wanted were gone too.
It might be. There's like a gap there. Like after, I guess, Robert, Machado, Devers, Albies, and even I guess Freddie Freeman. There seems to be pretty big drop off between those guys and like the Whit Merrifield and the Mullins. At that spot, I probably would have gone with another pitcher, even though I usually like to get one of each in the first two rounds when it works out that way. But yeah, that's the downside. Like I said, I like the top seven picks, but I don't like the bottom in the second round. So that's going to be something, depending on how ADP adjusts. Maybe there's guys that I've been targeting in the early to middle of the third round that are going to move up, and that will make more sense. But yeah, that late, mid to late second round is tough right now.
Yeah, I've really just sort of found that there's stuff to be annoyed by kind of wherever you're picking. Obviously you're totally right about the most desirable guys being obviously in the first half of the first round, then the second half of the second round kind of sucks. And I like picking at the turn and getting like two guys in the top 16, top 17, but then the guy that comes back in the third, to me, there's a bit of a drop off there too. So
There's a sweet spot. In the early DCs, with like the ninth pick, where you could get Cole or Burns at that point, and then get one of the good hitters on the way back. That was nice, but I don't think that's going to last. Cole and Burns are probably going to move up top five, and then the top seven, I think, is going to be pretty set. So it'll be hard to get a top seven guy combined with a good second round hitter. So I'll have to, when ADP settles, figure out the math where, which spot I like better.
And I've got a couple more early round. We're done making fun of my bad picks. But I've got a couple more early round sort of general questions for you. Maybe you touched on this one a little bit, just a second ago, but who is your least favorite quote unquote speed guy relative to ADP, who's going in the first 30 or 40 picks?
I'm going to go back to Marte. He ran a ton last year, but it's more than he's ever run. And part of that was Oakland just letting him go wild. But I don't know if that's going to last with the Mets. I'd say it's hard to expect more than 30 stolen bases. Maybe he ends up stealing 35, 40, 45, but I'm expecting about 30, and in Citi Field, 10 to 15 home runs with maybe 280 average is probably what seems like a fair expectation. So for me, out of a guy that you're not sure about the playing time, those numbers are similar to Witt, but you know Witt's going to have 650 to 700 plate appearances. So almost... probably 10 picks between the two. I think Witt makes more sense in the early third than Marte, where he's been going.
Yeah, the power thing with Marte is in the end what kind of scared me off of him, honestly, with that when I was deciding between him and Trout. Is I wasn't even sure he could get me to 12 homers. So that's kind of a scary proposition in the middle of the second round. All right, what about this one? Over the last 3 weeks in 15-team draft champions, Buehler, Scherzer, Woodruff, and Wheeler have been the order of pitchers 3 through 6. Do you see any of those four as clearly better or clearly worse than the others?
I have Woodruff and Wheeler ahead of the other two. One thing I'm going to say, Buehler as a start in his career, 2.73 ERA and 3.43 xFIP. And you can look at any projections. They're going to have Buehler lower than the rest, because a pitcher that outperforms his metrics like that, they're really hard to account for in projections. You can look at ground ball rate. You can look at their stuff, their movement. It's just hard to figure out why they're really outperforming their metrics. So I won't be drafting Buehler, but it doesn't mean it's a bad pick, because he's outperformed his metrics for the past 4 years, so he can probably do it again. But I'll be staying away, because I just prefer to stick to what I know. Scherzer, the one thing that worries me about him, he's 37 and he had that dead arm issue in the playoffs. And the other thing, last year he led the league in K minus walk ratio on 3-2 counts. And I've talked a little bit about this before on other podcasts. The 3-2 count numbers, it's one pitch that determines whether it's a strikeout or a walk. And there's a lot of variance in that number from year to year, especially in 2020. It was a big thing with the short season, where a lot of numbers were misleading because of that. Over a full season, not as bad, but Scherzer led the league. I think he was at 30%, and the second guy was at 20%. So his numbers look better than they should, I think, just because he performed well in 3-2 counts, but it's not something that usually carries over. So doesn't mean he's not a good pitcher. Doesn't mean he won't be healthy. It's just something that tells me that his numbers last year were a little bit misleading, and it's something that just enough to put him below the other two.
Have you noticed that Wheeler, like it just seems to me like he was going kind of at the turn in December, and now it's just weird to me that his ADP is now the lowest of those four over the last 3 weeks. Have you?
I haven't done too many. I didn't do that many early drafts. I was doing mostly best balls early in draft season, so I wasn't paying that much attention to ADP. I've seen him go with the term, but the ADP I have is, I think it's over the last month. He's been going around 20. So, I like in every NFBC main event, it's known for pitching moving up. So, right. Like he's gonna go probably late first once we get the main events. There's always I've been doing the past 2 weeks the $1,000 DCs, and let me see where he went in this one. He went at pick 16. And he was the sixth pitcher off the board at pick 16. So it's a pretty good indicator of what pitching is going to look like come March.
All right. This last early round question for you. Can you see yourself taking Vlad Guerrero in the first or Freddie Freeman in the second in any of your high stakes drafts?
Freeman probably more likely, or even Devers, similar profiles. If I get the speed in the first round, then I'm okay taking one of those two in the second round. Taking Vlad in the first and not knowing what's going to come back. And like I said, I don't like most of the speed guys in the second round. So I find it risky to take Vlad and not know what to expect. If he slips to, 12 or 13, I've seen him go 12 to in a recent draft. At that point, I'd probably consider it, but it's tough. I feel much better if I get at the turn, pairing Freeman or Devers with Albies, you're getting a little bit of everything. And that's probably more likely than taking a chance on Vlad and not knowing what I'll get in the second round.
All right. I want to close things out asking about this draft champions I alluded to that you and I were both in December. Now, you had a very interesting strategy. I think at one point people were talking in the chat about is Phil just trolling us? Is he just trying to throw us off the set? But it was really interesting to sort of see it play out. You got two starters and two closers in your first, seven or eight picks. And then you took nothing but hitters until round 23. And then 19 of your last 20 picks were pitchers. Is that, I guess, do you want to sort of maybe expand on sort of the thought process behind that strategy? My initial take was that maybe the easiest thing to get in the late rounds is just bulk innings from unsexy starting pitchers. Maybe there were just guys that you knew were going to be there that you really liked this year. What was kind of the thought process behind that general strategy?
That's kind of the strategy I've been using for draft champions for a while. One of the biggest thing for me, the hardest thing to do is project playing time. It is for a lot of people, but I just average a couple of sets of projections for playing time. And then I apply my rate projections to that playing time. So, in the late round DCs, you can find pitchers that are going to get 25, 30 games started, but you can't find hitters that are going to play every day. So I'd rather use my skills at finding the not really the better, but the not as worse pitchers, I guess, in the late rounds, than guessing on which hitters are going to get promoted or which ones are going to suddenly get full-time playing time. So that's the main idea behind it. Since then, though, I actually went through all the depth charts and made manual adjustments to playing time, where I think is worth it. And then in my last DC, I actually had 9 starters by round 27, just because I found a couple of hitters that I liked, probably around, 20 to 30, which I didn't really see in the first DC we did, which was in December, right? So, I just hadn't done the work at that point to figure out which hitters in rounds 20, 25, 30 were worth it. So, now that I've put in the work, I feel a little more comfortable with those guys. So I'm adjusting the strategy a little bit. But in general, I'm always more likely to draft starting pitchers late, just because I know they're more likely to play.
Yeah, I think that totally makes sense. That's interesting to me that you're much more comfortable projecting a hitter's per plate appearance production rather than projecting their actual like plate appearances.
Yeah. I mean, once we get to March and we see like spring training lineups, we see who's likely to start the year once the free agents are done. It's probably easier to do it at that point, but like third base with Toronto is a good example. Like Espinal, played pretty well last year. The Jays loved him, but there's been rumors of them saying it was Kyle Seager before he retired. And now I guess Chris Bryant maybe, or maybe they'll sign a shortstop but to move to third, or maybe Biggio will play there. We don't know. Like there's so many possibilities. And I think Seager before he retired, he's probably rumored to sign with 10 different teams. So all those 10 teams were just bumping down the starters' playing time just a little bit because we don't know what's going to happen. So usually there's going to be 9 starters on every team, but now there's only usually 5 or 6 that will feel comfortable in every team, and then all the other spots, well, it should be him, but we don't know for sure. The Phillies have like 1 outfielder right now with Harper, and he might play some DH. So we know they're going to sign some guys. If they don't, then other guys are going to get the playing time. But for now, it's just so hard to guess with so many free agents that are unsigned how it's going to end up. So in March, that's going to change. But for now, yeah, it's definitely easier to project skills for me than playing time.
So the last question I was going to ask you is about the 2 prospects you took in this DC. But now I'm wondering if these guys are even still targets for you in that range, based on what we were talking about earlier. You basically were taking mostly just kind of old, boring guys in the middle to late rounds. And then you mixed in Adley Rutschman and O'Neill Cruz. And I was hoping that you could talk those guys up and pump up their ADP a little bit. But are those guys that maybe you've cooled on a little bit since that draft?
Yeah, since I did that adjustment, thanks to you, both those guys moved down. I think Cruz probably moved down probably 20 spots in my rankings. So in my official rankings, but like even before then, if I was doing a $1,000 DC and Cruz was up there, I'd always take the safer guy. But in the 150 we did, some people were thinking I was trolling everyone, making random picks. I wasn't. But I was playing like a 150 DC where trying to go for the overall, shoot for the upside. And I saw those 2 guys. Pretty sure I got them after ADP. And I think the odds are low, but there's a chance that Cruz is the starting shortstop and gets 550, 600 plate appearances. And that I doubt he can reach his Steamer projection of, I think it's 281 batting average or something like that. But it's within maybe 90th percentile, maybe you can get there. So I was just shooting for upside mixed in with my regular boring old guys.
that DC was that was one of Mike the Mouth's fast DCs. Is that the greatest honor of your offseason to be invited to Mike the Mouth's fast DC?
Especially since it was marketed as Champions of Champions draft or something like that. So we won't give Mike too much credit, but it was cool to do that draft.
It's too kind of you to say that. Mike's friend of the show. Well, Phil, I really enjoyed this. I am crossing my fingers that the audio is okay. Do you want to let people know where they can follow you on Twitter? And I don't know if you want to pump up any of the future tour dates of your media tour, but anything you want to say to the listeners here?
Yeah, you can find me on Twitter at PhilDusso27. And then next week, the next stop in the podcast store is the Launch and Go podcast with Rob Silver and Jeff Zinnemann and Van Lee. So that should be a fun one. It's a podcast I've listened to for the past 2-3 years, pretty much every week. So I'm looking forward to talking to those guys, and it'll be interesting.
Awesome. Yeah, that's a great pod for sure. I'll be sure to check that out. Now that I'm done with this interview, I can go back and listen to all the other podcasts. But Phil, really appreciate you taking the time. This has been the RotoWire Fantasy Baseball Podcast, brought to you by WinBet. I'll be back next week talking with Clay Link about my updated top 400 prospect ranks.